the genocide which has been committed, the crimes against humanity which have been committed in Bosnia, those are the most serious crimes known to the conscience of mankind. And so it is not only the tendency, but it is the duty of human rights organizations around the world on behalf of the conscience of mankind, on behalf of the victims, that we must speak up and we must take every lawful and proper action to bring to justice the people who have properly been indicted.
Enforcing Human Rights on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Enforcing international human rights has always been a tricky business. Here to guide us through recent developments is Doug Castle, Executive Director of the International Human Rights Law Institute at DePaul University. Professor Castle has played key roles with both the Truth Commission in El Salvador and the UN Tribunal investigating and prosecuting war crimes in the former Yugoslavia.
The UN Tribunal has more than lived up to my expectations and probably shocked several of the permanent members of the Security Council who, in their wildest dreams, never anticipated, I would guess, that the Tribunal and its very able prosecutor, Judge Richard Goldstone from South Africa, would by mid-1995 have indicted the top civilian and military leadership of the Bosnian Serbs for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. But the news is precisely that the tribunal issued 46 indictments, including indictments against the top leaders, that is, those who have the command responsibility and who allegedly gave the orders to commit the worst atrocities in Europe since World War II. So that's the plus side. The negative side, of which many people are, of course, aware, is that of the 46 indicted defendants, only one, one Mr. Tadic, is in the physical custody of the court, which is located in The Hague in the Netherlands, and the case against him is now going forward with some very important legal motions being briefed and argued as we speak. As to the other 45 defendants, the question commonly comes up, well, what's the point of indicting people if you can't really punish them? And sometimes that question is taken to the point of saying, well, international prosecutions are meaningless. They're just another form of Western rhetoric that doesn't really do anything about these terrible atrocities taking place in the former Yugoslavia. My response to that is that the tribunal indictments already have a real and concrete meaning and may come to take on more significant meanings in the future. Why do I say that? Well, first of all, a world which hopes to call itself civilized cannot let pass genocide, ethnic cleansing, systematic rape, the kinds of things that we have seen in Bosnia, without the most severe form of moral condemnation that we can make. And at a minimum, the indictments, which are quite detailed, and which have procedures for the presentation of the evidence to support them, whether or not the defendants are taken into custody, constitute a form of moral sanction. The world is shown as clearly as can be shown the specific evidence against individuals responsible for the kind of activities that any human being ought to be ashamed of. It moves it out of the area of just sort of generally throwing up your hands at the conflicting sides and pinpointing individual responsibility for and participation in crimes against humanity. Secondly, there's an immediate concrete effect. This tribunal was created by the United Nations Security Council. Under the United Nations Charter, every member nation has a responsibility to cooperate with directives of the Security Council. And in this case, the Security Council has directed every member nation of the United Nations to assist the court by executing the warrants of arrest which have been issued for Mr. Karadzic, the civilian leader of the Bosnian Serbs, Mr. Mladic, the military leader of the Bosnian Serbs, and the other defendants. That means that Mr. Karadzic and Mr. Mladic and other Bosnian Serb leaders who have become accustomed to parading around the world as responsible statesmen and diplomats for purposes of peace negotiations now need to bear in mind whenever they contemplate leaving the territory of the Serb-held territory of Bosnia that they may well be subject to orders of arrest, capture, detention, and transfer to The Hague by every other government on earth except those governments which choose to be renegades and disobey the Security Council because of perhaps some affinity to the political cause of the Bosnian Serbs. So there's a very important geographical dimension. They're in effect under house arrest in their own territory. There's also a very important temporal dimension. That is, how far into the future can those two gentlemen and other defendants count on being sheltered from the international arrest warrant by whatever authorities may happen to be in control in Bosnia? We have seen many examples in recent years of former alleged Nazi war criminals being brought to trial decades after the atrocities of World War II. Can Mr. Karadzic and Mr. Mladic count on remaining safe from justice for decades into the future? What sort of political divisions will take place among Bosnian Serbs, among Serbs in general, in the future? Difficult to predict. Already we've seen recent newspaper accounts of an open split between Mr. Karadzic and Mr. Mladic. Mr. Karadzic has attempted to fire Mr. Mladic in the wake of the currently successful Croatian offensive against Serb-held territory. Mladic has responded by defying the efforts of Mr. Karadzic to dismiss him and has rounded up other Serb generals in his support. This particular conflict between the two of them may or may not ripen into a full-scale permanent split, but whether or not it does, there is a possibility that one side or the other of those internal factions may decide to not protect one or more of the defendants in the future. So there are no guarantees of prosecution here, but neither can we rule prosecution out once these indictments have been issued as they have.
All right. A couple of questions for you on that. One procedural question. Explain to us just the differences between proving that a crime against humanity occurred and convicting someone of a crime against humanity.
Well, you don't really prove that a crime against humanity has taken place unless you have sufficient evidence to convict, that is, evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. And in order to convict, you need to have not only sufficient proof in the form of evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, you also have to hold a fair trial and give the defendant an opportunity to defend himself, to present any evidence he might have, to cross-examine the prosecutor's evidence, and so forth. You can't have a fair trial under the rules of the tribunal unless and until the defendant is taken into custody, because the rules of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia preclude trying anyone in absentia. So the difference is essentially the prosecutor can have the proof. Under the rules of the court, he can publicly present that evidence, but we cannot say that someone has been convicted until not only has the proof been presented, but there's been an opportunity for the defendant to meet that proof, to cross-examine it, to rebut it if he can.
The cynical, pessimistic side of me says that there must be a loophole for the world community to get out of these indictments somehow. And what happens if the world does back down on these indictments?
Well, I think if the Security Council, because it is only the Security Council that would have the legal or the claim of legal authority to somehow nullify the indictments, if the Security Council were to back down, I think that would be a moral stain on the conscience of the members of the Security Council certainly of the West, the United States, and the Europe, where both France and the United Kingdom are members of the Security Council. And it would be an act that would be such an extreme reversal of current United States policy, both under the Bush administration and under the Clinton administration, that I think as a practical matter we can assume there is an extremely low likelihood of that happening, at least as long as the Clinton administration is in office, which means until early 1997. And then depending on the election results, we'll have to see where it goes from there. But the indictments are judicial acts. They cannot be voided if sufficient evidence is presented to support them. The only action which the Security Council could take would be simply to decline to enforce them, to enforce the arrest warrants in the event that question of enforceability were to be tested. But I don't think that's likely for at least the next 2 years. After that, it's very difficult to make predictions, especially with respect to the future.
R.A. Nair, one of the world's leading human rights advocates, recently said, quote, "The Bosnian Serb leaders can be certain that human rights advocates worldwide will never relent in their effort to secure the arrest of those actually indicted by the tribunal." Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. We have seen the efforts of Simon Wiesenthal and many other voices of conscience who have spent years and decades chasing down the Nazi war criminals from 50 years ago, and they are still doing it, even though we are now reaching the point where there are it's very difficult to secure convictions because of many of the witnesses are no longer with us, and those who are, their memories are not necessarily what they once might have been with regard to the events in question. But the genocide which has been committed, the crimes against humanity which have been committed in Bosnia, those are the most serious crimes known to the conscience of mankind. There is simply no more egregious offense against the values and the rules of conduct that human beings have managed to devise by the late 20th century. And so it is not only the tendency, but it is the duty of human rights organizations around the world on behalf of the conscience of mankind, on behalf of the victims, not only in this conflict, but the future victims in other conflicts if we don't take proper prosecutorial action in this one, that we must speak up and we must take every lawful and proper action to bring to justice the people who have properly been indicted.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground about enforcing international human rights laws. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available from Journal Graphics. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Our guest, Professor Doug Castle, is Executive Director of the International Human Rights Law Institute at DePaul University.
The United Nations, before it set up the International Criminal Tribunal, created in October of 1992 an international commission of experts to investigate violations of humanitarian law in the former Yugoslavia. One of the five international members of that commission was Professor M. Sharif Bassiouni of DePaul University College of Law, who was the president of our institute. However, when the UN Security Council created that investigative commission, the council unfortunately did not give it the funds necessary to conduct factual investigations. The only funding provided was for the five members and a couple of secretaries to travel to Geneva once a month to have meetings, reflecting the ambivalence on the part of the Security Council at that time as to whether it really did wish to see serious prosecutions. The United States, in my view, did. Other members of the Security Council, of the permanent members, did not. Professor Bassiouni got in touch with a couple of private foundations, the MacArthur Foundation here in Chicago and the Soros Foundations of George Soros in New York. Those two foundations generously provided, between the two of them, more than $1 million in funding, which our institute used to establish a documentary database here at DePaul, in which we received all of the reports of atrocities in the former Yugoslavia that came to the attention of the United Nations from any member government, from any human rights organization, from the press, from any source whatsoever, and placed all of that information into a computerized database where it is retrievable by all kinds of variables such as the location, time, nature of the offense, name of the defendant, name of the victim, and so on. And all of that information was compiled both in computer software form and in hard copy form with analyses of the information prepared by a team of lawyers and law students here at DePaul. And all of it is now in the possession of the prosecutor, Judge Goldstone, in The Hague. We've turned over all that evidence to him. And it is our understanding that that evidence has provided a considerable running head start, if you will, for the prosecutor, and enabled him to move much more quickly toward the stage of indictments than might otherwise have been the case. That information is also being used in the legal debates that are taking place before the court right now. For example, the United States government recently filed a friend of the court brief with the tribunal in opposition to a motion by the one defendant who is in custody, Mr. Tadic, in which Mr. Tadic argued that the court did not have jurisdiction over the case because the Yugoslavia conflict, he said, was not an international conflict but a domestic conflict. The United States government's amicus brief cites extensive evidence compiled by the analysts here at DePaul on behalf of the commission, explaining the various international links between, for example, the Bosnian Serbs and the Serbian, predominantly Serbian army of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, to justify the position of the United States that indeed the conflict in Yugoslavia is and has been international in character.
Other work of the Institute you want to tell us about?
The Institute was founded in 1990 for the purpose of attempting to promote the development of and awareness of international law as one way to protect human rights. We do that through not only directly working on matters such as the Yugoslavia Tribunal, but also through public education efforts. I have a weekly radio program on public radio here in Chicago. We write articles for newspapers. We do training programs. We bring in judges and lawyers from other countries as well as from the United States and train them in international human rights law. We travel to other countries, give training seminars, and provide technical assistance. A couple of years ago, I had the privilege to serve as legal advisor to the United Nations Truth Commission for El Salvador, which investigated the atrocities during the war in that country and issued a lengthy report. We also do advocacy work. We have met with members of the officials of the State Department, the National Security Council, and urged them to take such actions as to promote ratification by the United States of treaties concerning human rights, or otherwise to act in support of human rights. So whatever relates to the use of law to support human rights, within the limited resources of our academic institute here in the Midwest, we try to do what we can.
I want to finish up with a couple of questions about the Truth Commission. I want to know about your role, and also just comment for us on the significance and the uniqueness of this new UN device, the Truth Commission.
Well, my role was to serve as one of three of the principal legal advisors to the commission. There were three members of the commission, former President Belisario Betancur of Colombia, former Foreign Minister Reynaldo Figueredo of Venezuela, and Professor Thomas Bergenthal of the United States, a former president of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. Each of those three members retained a legal advisor. The three of us worked together as a team. It was our responsibility to oversee the investigations, to direct the flow of staff investigative resources, assist the investigators in determining what leads to follow up, then later on to assist the commissioners by preparing drafts of the reports of the investigations and ultimately of their report as a whole, and to give them counsel on legal questions and evidentiary questions that arose in the context of the investigation. This was an unprecedented international effort to essentially have the international community do what normally a national judiciary should do, namely investigate serious crimes and discover and publicly reveal the facts. But because precisely part of the problem in El Salvador is that the judiciary was non-functional in human rights cases, the normal way to do it was blocked. And so it wasn't going to get done unless the international community did it. The effort was apparently so successful that it is one which we may not see repeated soon, precisely because the military regimes in a number of other countries who have seen what happened in El Salvador, where the entire high command of the army was essentially identified as having been responsible for serious violations of human rights. We now find a situation where, since that report was issued in 1993, no other government has agreed to such a commission. Other governments have agreed to something called truth commissions, Guatemala, Haiti, South Africa, but none has agreed to a commission composed of international representatives, essentially given a free rein to find facts against whomever on whatever the evidence might lead. So it's a unique effort which may not soon be repeated, if ever, but I think it has contributed to revealing the truth about extremely important events in El Salvador, such as the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, massacres of hundreds of peasants at El Mozote and other places, and the assassinations of six Jesuit priests and two women only 6 years ago. So it's made an important contribution in that context. It will be a tough act to follow.
Let's say it does, that there are more truth commissions or similar things out there that do happen in the future. What do we do in the wake of one of these truth commission reports? I suppose the range is from one end where you prosecute everyone who's listed as a potential human rights violator to the other end where you grant full and complete pardons and amnesties at the other end of the spectrum. Where do you come down on this? What should happen after a truth commission report is released?
In any situation where there are extremely widespread violations of human rights and a very large number of persons involved, it is simply not practical to prosecute everyone. The resources simply aren't there, and the political will is usually lacking as well. On the other hand, the so-called solution of an amnesty where the slate is wiped clean, and where even those who were most responsible and who orchestrated the systematic violations, assuming there are such people, where even they are given a free pass, if that's allowed to happen, that essentially is a mockery of the principles of human rights and individual responsibility on which modern international human rights law is based. So my personal position, which I believe is consistent with the emerging jurisprudence of a number of international human rights bodies, is that in such situations, at least those with command responsibility may not be amnestied and should be the subject of vigorous investigation and prosecution to the extent the evidence is available. When you start getting below that level, down to the people who were involved not in giving the orders, but in carrying them out, then I think it becomes a matter of selectivity. Sometimes there is a case for some form of at least de facto amnesty, for such people, if only because it is simply not feasible in many cases to prosecute them. But a blanket amnesty, even for those at the top, is something which is, in my view, inconsistent with the obligations of states under modern international human rights law, which are not only to refrain from violating rights, but to take positive, affirmative steps to attempt to guarantee and protect rights.
I'll finish with one big picture question. When you look around the world at the situation of human rights, do you feel mostly positive or mostly negative about the way things are going?
It's a very mixed picture. At 1989, 1990, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fall of the so-called communism in the Eastern Europe, I, for one, had a great deal of hope, in retrospect, excessively naive hope, that we could now be rapidly on the road toward a more peaceful and just world. Obviously, the genocide in Rwanda, the genocide in the former Yugoslavia, the massive and bloody wars in some of the republics of the former Soviet Union, the disintegration of states in places like Somalia, the continued repression in countries like Guatemala and Peru, have dashed whatever hopes I and others might have had for a radically new world in short order. On the other hand, I think there has been progress made in a number of places in terms of both building new democratic governments, particularly in Africa and Latin America. Incipient democracies, admittedly, but regimes which are at least on the road away from authoritarianism and toward participatory democracy. And at the same time, we've seen new institutions like the Truth Commission in El Salvador, like this International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which have begun to show that the international community can do more now and in the future to attempt to prevent and to punish serious violations of human rights than it did in the past. So I think we have a long, difficult road ahead of us, but I think we are, in important respects, moving forward. And as a human being and as a lawyer, I view it as my responsibility and my job to try to keep pushing us, even if it is inch by inch, foot by foot, down that road toward a world which more closely reflects the ideals of humanity than the one in which, unfortunately, so many people are suffering at the end of the 20th century.
That is Doug Castle, Executive Director of the International Human Rights Law Institute at DePaul University. For Common Ground, I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9535, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9535. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.